Hi, this is Larry Namer, founder of E! Entertainment Television, and this is my startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story. And every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning. And every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story.
When we launched in January of this year, we launched with three episodes. The thought process was to play off the binge factor that Netflix has made ever so incredibly popular. Well, when the Startup Story launched this past January, we had absolutely no audience. Yet we came out the gate with three incredible founder stories. Last week, we replayed episode one with Jason McCann, the founder of Veridesk. If you haven't heard it, definitely go back and listen to it. It's unbelievable. And this week, we're replaying episode two with Larry Namer, the founder of E! Entertainment Television. Yes, that E! Entertainment Television, the one that made the Kardashians ever so popular. But don't worry, Larry doesn't take credit for the Kardashians. He sold the company for $3.5 billion long before the Kardashians ever came around. But the reason we're replaying our first two episodes is because depending upon how much you love podcasts, there's a very high chance that you have not heard our first few episodes, especially because we're now 35 episodes deep into our journey. Like I said, when we launched, we had very few listeners, and now we're approaching 20,000 listeners each month. For that reason, we have brought the first two episodes off the shelf to ensure they make your podcast queue. With that said, I hope you enjoy this episode as it originally aired on our launch date of January 15, 2019. Your age will probably determine what shows come to mind when you think of E! Entertainment Television. If you are 35 years or older, like myself, you will probably think of the hilarious show Talk Soup with Greg Kinnear or Joel McHale, a television show that mocked, well, other television shows. If you're under the age of 30, you might think of Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Either way, E! Entertainment Television has a very significant audience draw across the cable platforms. This episode of The Startup Story features Larry Namer, the founder of E! Entertainment Television. Now, for the record, Larry had nothing to do with the Kardashian phenomenon that has taken over pop culture today. He did, however, have everything to do with the building of a media network in the mid-1980s that eventually sold for approximately $3 billion in 2007. At first glance, you might be thinking, cable was so new in the mid-80s, it's just a matter of capitalizing on time and history. While there may be some validity to that thinking, E's startup story is about Larry's conviction that there was no way he was going to let E fail. In this episode, you will learn how Larry maneuvered the early days of E with only $60 remaining in his bank account. You'll learn how he built his company with only raising 3% of the money he tried 3 years to raise. You'll also hear how he learned to constantly adapt his business to ensure success regardless of the external circumstances he faced. Wherever you are at in your entrepreneurial journey, Larry's story will speak to you directly and provide you with a fresh perspective to take into your endeavors. If you don't believe me, let me just start by saying that Larry's story does not begin on the glamorous side of Hollywood. In fact, Larry's startup story begins in the sewers of Manhattan, New York.
Somebody I knew, his dad was a electrician in New York, and said, oh, my father, you know, he's part of the electricians union. They just organized this thing called cable television. I'm not quite sure what it is, but we could probably get you an interview. So I did get an interview at a company called Sterling Manhattan, the precursor to Manhattan Cable, which was the precursor to Time Inc. Cable. So I got a job there. I think I lied. I think I put down that I had no education because I needed the job. So they gave me a job being an assistant splicer underground, which meant I worked in the sewers of Manhattan.
Oh, my goodness.
Where I would literally, 8:30 in the morning, I would go down the sewer and I'd splice cables together and for what eventually became the cable system that powered all of Manhattan. But it was a great time to be there. The company, while nobody knew it or what it was at the beginning, Time Inc. came in a year after I joined, and they bought the company. So Time Inc. at that point was a magazine company.
Okay.
And it was very interesting because you had all these, you know, the Yale and the Harvard guys sitting up on 6th Avenue, and a lot of them trying to figure out what it is those guys in the sewers do. And then eventually somebody in human resources said, wait a second, there's a guy with an economics degree that does that. So I kind of became the de facto translator between the tech guys who very rarely even had a high school diploma and Harvard and Yale's and stuff like that. So it was a great time to be there because Time Inc. decided that over 10 years, and this is kind of like 71 to 81, that they were going to migrate their company from being a printing company to becoming a media company.
Oh, interesting.
And actually, the study that was done jointly with IBM, which IBM read the study and poo-pooed it and said, ah, ridiculous. But Time Inc. decided they were going to make that transformation. And it was a great time because it was the beginning of big city cable systems. While I was there, you know, we built Manhattan, which was the first underground big city system that was really dependent more on programming, where, you know, the rural systems were all on telephone poles to bring people television where they never had it before. And then programming, you know, 1973, a guy named Jerry Levin came in there and who was there, but he kind of rose and said, I heard about these things called satellites. I think we're going to start putting movies on them. And we were going, really, Jerry, what's a satellite? And, you know, so that was the beginning of HBO. And then we did Cinemax. And so a lot of things came out of that group in that 10 years, a lot of innovation. So it was a great place to be because I got to do stuff really young that most people in the staid timing family didn't get to do until they were in their 50s.
So you were a part of the early days of HBO.
Yeah, I was there. I was part of what was known as the Time Inc. Video Group.
Okay.
And we all helped each other. So I was on the cable operations side.
Okay.
But you know, HBO at one point was in the same offices and stuff. It was kind of incubated there. And we crossed over and did a lot of stuff and stuff. And it was kind of there where I started becoming a little bit fascinated in the programming side because I would see all this exciting stuff. And I go, gee, that's a lot more interesting than working with the rats in the sewers and stuff like that.
So while you were in the sewers, though, what were you thinking your career? Because I'm assuming you didn't have any entrepreneurial endeavors while you're in the sewers, right? Was your mindset just kind of climb the ranks, or what were you thinking in the sewers?
My mindset, well, my mindset was just, this is a nice temp job. I can't wait to get out of here. But then, you know, I think when Time Inc. came in, and I started to say, hey, wait a second. This has got possibilities here, and this could be exciting, and this could be a big company. It really was focused much more on being able to climb the ranks. And I did climb rather quickly there. I mean, I think I was 23 when I was on the union side. I think I was 23 when they put me as the vice chairman of the division of the union, simply because I knew how to read. I could actually read contracts and stuff like that. And so I represented, you know, literally thousands of cable workers and the union thing, which was just bizarre.
Yeah.
But then the management guys wanted me to move over to management, which at first I refused, but then they lured me over. I saw the opportunity to rise. I think at that point, my aspiration was to maybe one day become a vice president of the company and stuff. Then after, you know, kind of after that, I look back and I go, really? I once wanted to be that? Because I think at some point I kind of passed that.
Yeah. Do you think, just to kind of stay in that moment for a minute there when you had aspirations of being a VP, do you think a lot of that mindset was related to your upbringing? Your parents had stable jobs. Were they first generation U.S.?
Yeah, they were first. It was definitely that. I mean, my family's aspiration for me was get a civil service job and, you know, be able to retire with a pension and stuff like that. So there was no thoughts of being an entrepreneur whatsoever. It was just rising up in the corporate ranks that they were supportive of that. They were thinking you should work for the city and, you know, you're more guaranteed.
Yeah.
What's this cable thing and how do we know it'll be around tomorrow? But, you know, I kind of knew that this cable thing was not going away and it was going to be big and stuff. So I just stuck with it for 10 years.
So when you were at Time and you're getting this experience with HBO, if I'm not mistaken, you actually, on the HBO side, you were integral in the expansion of that whole business unit, weren't you?
I eventually, and again, this is kind of fun because I was really young when I got to do all this stuff. I was 25. They made me the director of operations.
Oh my goodness.
Which I had like 300 and some odd people, a lot of technical people, engineers and I mean, like real engineers and stuff reporting to me, and you know, and then having to go read books to find out what the people who work for me do, which I did. I just started reading books. And then they made me the head of corporate development, which was finding out things, figuring out businesses that we could build on the back of the cable system that were non-entertainment. So even way back then, I was doing remote data things. We were running special cables throughout Manhattan so that a bank uptown could talk to a bank downtown. Their computers could talk to each other.
Oh, so you, because you had the infrastructure, you were looking, you were part of what the driving force for monetizing that infrastructure.
That was exactly it. And, and over a short period of time, so we were saying, you know, banks could talk to each other on, at then that point, with T1 circuits, which were, you know, unheard of, talking 79. And very quickly, it actually became the number one source of profits for the cable system because the margins were much, much bigger. I mean, you charge somebody $12 for a cable hookup, but you could charge a bank $1,200 for the hooking up one computer to the other on essentially the same kind of bandwidth. So it was a much, much more efficient use of it. It was basically all about finding efficient uses of bandwidth.
Yeah. So as you're with Time, you're climbing the ranks, you're doing incredible things. A part of, I mean, now looking back, a part of the early days of some incredible opportunities. When did the idea start percolating about doing something on your own?
What happened was I hit the 10-year, you know, is where you qualify for the pension and you're 30 years old. You go, wait a second. It was kind of then I'm going, really? You know, 30 years old and I'm qualifying for a pension? I said, I'm not sure this is where I'm supposed to be. But I was a true New Yorker. I'd never thought of, I moved to Manhattan, you know, which was the aspiration of every kid from Brooklyn at that point. But then I somebody called me to recruit me to come to a cable system in Los Angeles. But it actually wasn't a cable system. It was a company that won the cable franchise, and nothing was built here. So basically, all they did was they had a piece of paper from the city of L.A. saying, you now have the right to build the San Fernando Valley. They had a bank commitment from Toronto Dominion, and they needed somebody to come and build it. But, you know, while there were cable systems all around the country, the city of Los Angeles, when they wrote the franchise, insisted that the cables go underground, not on telephone poles. So this company had to find someone who knew how to build underground. Well, at that point, only Manhattan Cable was built, and I was the only one who knew how to build underground. I got called. I first refused, I think, two or three times. I said, listen, I'm a New Yorker. I'm not moving to California. But then they convinced me to come out for a weekend and pitch me and stuff like that. And they said, well, what would it take for you to move here? And I named like four times what I was making in New York. And they said I was out of my mind. And I said, yes, you're probably right. I said, but your question was, what would it take? And I told you what it would take. Yeah, I said, I'm not looking to make a lateral move and stuff. I'm really fine in New York, and I got a great new apartment in the city. And I went back to New York, and it was like one of those winter days. There was snow on the ground, and it was like second day. And second day snow in New York is black. It's not white. And I'm standing there wearing my suit, you know, on while I'm walking to work, and cab goes by and splashes like black, wet, cold slush all over me. And I just said, really, did I really refuse that job? Anyway, like 2 days later, the guy called again and said, listen, you know, what you asked for is outrageous, but okay. And
that's,
I was like,
awesome.
Really?
I love that.
And he said, yeah. He goes, how fast can you be here? I said, well, 2 weeks, I guess. And I literally walked in, quit that day, packed up my stuff, and came out to California to build what's now Valley Cable, which was the first 61-channel two-way cable system ever built. For me, it was a great opportunity because now I moved totally out of the operations side. And then I now had finance and marketing and programming. You know, I was the general manager, so everything reported to me. So I got fascinated with all the other stuff and stuff. And I kept thinking that, hey, maybe there should be this, maybe there should be that. Then what happened was the company that I had worked for decided to sell out and move back to Canada. And I said, you know, I didn't move from New York to L.A. to go to Toronto. And so I had left there. A friend of mine and I were just kicking around. Now, that was kind of the point where I said, you know what? Maybe it's time I did this for myself.
And how old were you at this time?
32, 33.
Lots of experience from the sewers up through management at Time, now building the entire cable system in the valley. And so lots of experience there. And now you're 32-ish.
So a friend of mine and I, we just kept kicking around ideas, said, you know, I could go work for another cable system, but that's not really what I want to do. And my friend was in the real estate business. And he said, I didn't really want to be in the real estate business. I always wanted to be in entertainment. So we just said, okay, let's think of something kind of interesting to do. So we kept kicking around stuff. And it was, you know, not long after things like MTV started and whatever. And just started reading articles and studying the entertainment business. Somebody did a speech that we went and listened to talking about the incredibly high cost of advertising motion pictures. And, you know, we're talking to each other, they go, yeah, but they're doing things kind of ass backwards. The most efficient marketing vehicle you have for a movie is the trailer, but you only see the trailer when you're in the movie. I said, but you're already there.
Yeah.
So wouldn't it be good if you found a way to bring the trailer into people's homes where that could actually influence them on which movie to go? So when we kept trying to play with the thing, we said, wait a second, this is MTV of the movies. With MTV, people would turn to the green screen and say, and now Madonna has a new video. We said, why can't we have a host there going, and Schwarzenegger has a new film, and basically take the low cost or the efficiencies of doing just the host stand-ups and putting them against, you know, the best 2 minutes of a $50 million movie or $100 million movie. We didn't have to make the movie. We just had to do the cheap stand-ups.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how we started. You know, we originally called it Movie Time, but we did find an innovative technology then. It was the technology that was being used for the Weather Channel,
okay,
where the Weather Channel is a national video feed. So the video that everybody saw was the same, but in each different city, there was a little ticker that ran on the bottom, mm-hmm, that would tell them what the local weather forecast was. So that you would see it differently in Santa Barbara than I would see it in New York or whatever. So we said, gee, wouldn't that be interesting if we could not only show the trailers, but run the local movie theater times?
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So saying, yeah, instead of weather, it's movie times.
Yeah.
So that's the way we started. We wrote up a business plan for Movie Time. We thought it was such a great idea, and people would read it and they go, well, yeah, it's an interesting idea, but you're not Rupert Murdoch or Ted Turner. You don't just go out and start TV networks.
Actually, let's pause on that for a second, because let's set the context for what you were trying to do, right? I mean, you know, I heard an interview with Michael Dubin, the founder of Dollar Shave Club, and when he started, he was entering a market that Gillette had 72% market share. From all appearances, early stages, he was crazy for trying to do that. So who were the big players in the period that you were starting up Movie Time to become E?
But well, there was John Malone, who had TCI and Liberty, then became Liberty. There was Rupert Murdoch, who of course, there was Time Inc. Then there was Paramount, Disney.
So at that time, the studios as well had their own cable networks.
A lot of studios had their own cable networks.
So was MTV the first independent?
No, MTV was not independent. MTV was Viacom.
From the early days, they were Viacom.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought they started and were
they're
required.
Still, they started out as a... As in a big company, and they had lots of resources and stuff like that. But the breakthrough guys were basically BET, Bob Johnson, Discovery, and us.
Wow. So you were very early stage on independence. Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah, we were. And, you know, and people just said, you can't do it and it's impossible and stuff like that. But I think it was my background in Time Inc. where I knew who I was going up against. I mean, I worked with them and for them for years.
Yeah.
I said, I can tackle that.
Hey, everybody. I really do hope you love the startup story. Did you know that you can actually get paid just for listening to each episode we release? I know it sounds insane, but it's true. There's a free new app called Podcoin, and it literally pays you to listen to podcasts. Here's how it works. You listen to podcasts and you earn Podcoin while you listen. Then you turn that Podcoin in for gift cards or places like Amazon and Starbucks. Or if you're feeling even more generous, you can donate that Podcoin to charity. The more you listen, the more you earn. So here's what you do. You download the app right now on iPhone or Android, and I have a special code for you. Simply use our code STARTUPSTORY, one word, STARTUPSTORY, and you'll get 300 Podcoin just for signing up. And if you listen to enough of the Startup Story within the app, you can get a cappuccino at Starbucks or an Amazon gift card on us just for listening to me. So go ahead and start listening to the Startup Story on Podcoin and sign up with the code Startup Story. I swear it'll change the way you listen to podcasts. Now let's jump back into our episode. What was it about the opportunity that was so appealing that it was worth the obstacles that were in front of you?
Number one, I wanted to stay in LA. So okay. I wanted to find something that I could do here. Number two, I became fascinated with the entertainment business and some of the incredible inefficiencies that I saw of it. I mean, the movie trailer thing being the same thing. Yeah. Is like the only time I see a good marketing for a movie is when I'm already in a movie. I said, that's kind of backwards. But the more, you know, we looked at it, we saw the unbelievable opportunity. Everybody used this analogy saying cable TV is like an electronic newspaper. It's CNN is the headline, MTV is the music section, ESPN is the sports section. But if you really looked at the numbers for let's say the Sunday paper, the second most read section in any paper was the entertainment section. And we said, wait a second, that's the only thing that's really missing from the picture. And so we went out saying, we're going to create the video version of the entertainment section of a newspaper. And that's really where we saw the upside there is to become that important.
So you're at this time when you're pitching movie time at the time, when you're pitching movie time, were you still working at the Valley Cable?
Or No, I was. They had already moved back.
Got it. Okay.
So I was now out, and Alan and I went around and we always thought it was a good idea, but I think I was down to like $60 in the bank or something like that. And so I actually started to get worried, you know, saying, gee, maybe I was wrong here. Maybe I really should just take another job building.
Why didn't you at that point in time? Because I think a lot of people, they get down to that point, $60 in the bank account, knowing the resume can get them a job anywhere. What was it that you were just convinced of as to why you kept moving forward?
Well, the more we went on and the more people objected, I realized that their objections were not really good objections and stuff. And that I would, you know, I just became more and more convinced that I was right and they were wrong. And that this was just going to be finding the right place to bring this to. And we'll get it done. And that's literally what happened. We spent 3.5 years of people telling us you're not Rupert Murdoch. And then we finally found a venture capital group with vision. And
who, and your partner, Alan, he was a real estate guy at the time. Was he fully dedicated in the movie time as well? Or was he still working on the...
No, he came out here from New Jersey.
Okay.
And together, you know, he and I, we actually had a third partner at the beginning who along the way became a non-believer. So kind of when you hit that 2-year period, he's going like, you guys are out of your mind. This is never going to happen. Why don't you just buy me out? Which we did.
Yeah, with your $60.
which, you know, just some crazy. I think he had like almost a third of the company. And I think we bought it for like $20,000 or something. And then he sued us and told the judge that, well, they should have told me was going to be successful. And the judge threw it out and said,
course.
Don't ever come back here.
Of course. Oh, my goodness. So you finally, after 2 years pitching and
three
and a half years of pitching, no one investing, you're down to your lot, you know, your $60. There's probably some doubt that's playing in your head, but you're still determined because you're just like, these guys are idiots. They don't know what they're talking about. This has got to play out. And I love that determination. You believed in it to the point of only sitting on $60. You pitch. And how did that first investment catapult movie time?
Yeah, it was, we were flying to New York for a pitch meeting with someone. We're kind of going over the business plan and we're kind of going back and forth to make sure we both knew the numbers exactly the same way. And a guy sitting not far from us, you know, said, oh, that sounds like a TV network. What are you guys doing? And we told him. And he says, that's brilliant. When are you going to do it? We said, well, you know, we don't have any money. And the guy said, well, I'm in charge of acquisitions and divestitures for Warner Brothers. He goes, I can't do a deal like that because you're a startup. But he says, but I know of companies that would love to hear this pitch. He goes, it's a really good idea. And we were like, you know, after 3.5 years of getting kicked over to the curb, we were like, yeah, okay, whatever, you know, give us his name. So he gave us the name and we called up and we went in to see. And it was funny because it was an investment bank on Wall Street that had just, it was a bond house, I'm sorry, that had just started an investment banking division. So they really didn't have a lot of deals going.
Yeah.
And we walk in and we go into the guy's office and it's a young guy who had taken over the investment banking division. And we look on the wall and it's got movie posters on the wall. And Alan and I just looked at us and said, you know, we said, no, it can't be. And then he started telling us how he was the entertainment reporter for his college newspaper and stuff like that. And, you know, at the end of the day, he said, I really love this. He goes, I'm not allowed to sign for $60 million, which is what it cost to start a TV network. He goes, I'm only allowed to sign for 2.5. And we're going, but what are we going to do with 2.5? It requires 6. And MSNBC had just started up around then, or all the numbers were coming in at around 55 to 65 million. Okay. And he said, well, but I'm only allowed to sign for 2.5. So finally, we just said, you know what? Give us 2.5. I said, we'll figure it out. And they did. You know, I give them credit for taking that leap of faith. And so with our $2.5 million, we went back to L.A. and started preparing to launch this network. So I called a friend who worked at, you know, who was at teaching at University of Texas in Austin. And I said, I need, he was teaching radio, television, film. I said, do you have any kids who need intern jobs? And he said, yeah. He goes, I got a lot of them. It's hard to find internships for these kids. I said, send them to L.A.
Oh, that's awesome.
So we ended up with like 31 interns. We had 11 employees, 31 interns. With that, we figured out how to launch the channel. And it was interesting because the fact that we didn't have money led us to a lot of innovation.
Yeah.
Like, he was totally innovative when we started and stuff. And it was just because we had to be. I mean, we just didn't have the money.
Yeah.
So we were buying used industrial equipment that a company would use to make their in-house training tapes. And then they graduated to real equipment. We would buy the old equipment, stuff like that. We built our first studio in a freight train rail station.
That's fantastic.
It was pretty crazy stuff.
So with your $2.5 million and your 30 interns, obviously you had to adapt your business model that you had for $60 million. And I assume that when you took your $2.5 million investment, you said, this has got to get us to money at some point. Like, we've got to be able to launch and, you know, advertising or have sponsors or whatever the case may be. What adaptations did you make to your game and your launch plan to accommodate the reduced investment?
Yeah, we had always planned to be, call it Entertainment Tonight 24 hours a day. So in the original plan, there was lots of original programming and stuff like that. The cheapest part of our programming was taking these movie trailers, which we'd get from the studios for free, and having hosts kind of like the video jockeys that MTV had, and having them introduce all these clips. So we came up with 10 different ways to have clip shows and stuff, and just said, okay, all the original programming has to wait, and just put it all aside, and just went with the most efficient, most economical thing we could do. And as it turned out, people actually loved it because, you know, you go to the movies and you're seeing the best 2 minutes of a movie. So that's the way we started, and that's the way we kept the cost down. But as soon as we went on the air, you know, we did a few things smart. We put the company in Hollywood, which, even though Hollywood is always considered the entertainment capital of the world, there was no TV station that came out of Hollywood.
Oh, wow.
So, it was kind of strange.
It was all New York or?
All New York or all of Burbank or Culver City or something.
Okay.
There was no TV station that came out of Hollywood.
Oh,
so
wow.
We decided we're going to put the company in Hollywood, and then got all the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce and stuff to get behind us.
Yeah.
So when we did the launch, we actually had Jack Valente, who was the head of the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association. He actually came and pulled the switch and, you know, did all of that, which brought a lot of attention to it. People going, Jack Valente's pulling the switch on a little cable network in Hollywood, and what's that about? So, you know, we did that. We were very, very diligent on picking hosts. We realized that if we're not going to have money to make fabulous programming, we needed to have fabulous hosts. So I think we put over 7,000 people on tape to pick the first five hosts.
Oh, my goodness.
And stuff. And it's funny because afterwards people say to us, they go, oh, you were so lucky you had those great hosts. You know, we weren't lucky. We just realized what it was. We had a, with limited money, what we had to focus on.
And, you know, can you, for those listening, I can only think of one of those hosts, but can you share those beginning hosts that you had?
Oh, sure. Greg Kinnear.
Huge name.
Julie Moran went on to do Wireless Sports and Entertainment Tonight.
Yep.
Mark DiCarlo went on to do Studs.
Oh, yeah.
You had Richard Blade, K-Rock, and many things. You had Katie Wagner, Bob Wagner's daughter, who went on to do Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
Yeah. And these were people that had nothing.
They were never
before.
On TV.
You just saw something in it, and you took
Sam Rubin, who's now the big, he's 20-something years, the top entertainment reporter for news here in L.A. Yep. So we had Sam, and it was just, we picked well.
That is awesome. I mean, I remember Greg Kinnear and the early days. So it's interesting to see that, to know that he was picked out of 7,000 and had nothing, didn't have a pedigree before E. So you get your hosts. What were the early days of E like, the trying to get coverage and get a credibility within the industry?
We were pretty inventive. So we went, now I had come out of the cable world, so I knew a lot of the cable operators. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I talk to them about it, they go, Larry, it sounds interesting, but, you know, how do we know you're going to get the studios to give you the stuff that you're talking about? So I had met with this woman. Her name was T.G. Wilkerson Cassell. She owned the Hollywood Reporter magazine, which at that time, trade magazines, Variety and Hollywood Reporter were it.
Yeah.
I mean, you woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning and you read those because you didn't want to go to work not knowing what was in those those things. And I talked to her and she said, Larry, it's an interesting idea. She says, but I'll give you, you know, advertising in the paper. And just give me some stock, you know. She said, I just wish you luck. You know, she was very supportive of entrepreneurship.
That's awesome.
And so we would go and I would talk to a studio. And the first studio who really came on a big way was Universal.
Okay.
And we went over and they said, we don't think you're ever really going to be that big. But if you are, you know, we want to hedge our bets. So they were giving us clips and helping us get interviews with stars and stuff like that. They kind of saw the vision. So we would take out an ad in the Hollywood Reporter saying, you know, we'd like to thank Universal for coming on as our programming partner.
Oh, that's smart.
And then we would just rip the pages out and we'd send them to every cable operator in the country. And then I would call them and say, you didn't think we could do it, but here you go. Yeah. Universal is a partner. So I get a cable system to sign on. Then I do another ad and say, we'd like to thank Manhattan Cable for joining our list of affiliates. And we'd rip that out and then we'd send it to Disney and then we'd send it to Paramount. And so we just literally kept going
hustle.
Back and forth.
I love that hustle. That is outstanding. Again, and then what I love, hearing this story, I just love that you wanted 60 million, you got 2.5, and you still you made it happen. And you were just inventive and innovative with that.
And like I say, you know, it really did, the fact that it forced us into innovation.
Yeah.
I mean, we just didn't have a choice. I mean, our first voiceover booth, you know, and Greg Kinnear, you know, with Greg and stuff, it was literally a closet in a conference room. The hosts were like, really? I got to go do my voiceovers in a closet. But it gave it this very pirate look.
Yeah.
It was clearly different than anything you've ever seen. And because we didn't have enough money to retape things, a lot of times you'd see a host make a mistake and we would just keep rolling tape, which we used to do with Greg all the time, you know. But then girls started going, oh, he's so cute when he makes mistakes. We love when he raises his eyebrows and, you know, we're going, geez, you know, it's amazing what's, you know, happening. You know, Greg blew up and Julie Moran and, you know, they all did really well.
When did you know? I mean, obviously, we know the story of E now. I don't think everyone knows that it sold at some point in time for $3 billion, I think it was. So I don't know if everyone knows that, but you can Google it. You can find the stats on it. But when did you know? You know, you're recording in a closet. At what point, what event happened where you said, now we've got this. Like, I know this is going to succeed.
The day that Jack Palance, they pulled the switch. Oh. When we got that far, you know, when he pulled that switch, I just kind of went, we did it. But, you know, the person next to me says, no, no, Larry, you don't understand. You know, you spent the last 6 months building up to this point, literally working 16-hour days. He goes, now think you got to do this every day for the rest of your life. With a TV network, it's funny because it's never off. It's on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And running one is kind of interesting because even though you're in charge of the product, you never really get to see all the product because you can't.
Oh, that's a great point. Oh, wow.
So you really had to build a management team that you could try, that I could go to sleep at night knowing that they were going to do things the right way and stuff like that because you couldn't see what they were doing.
So knowing that your initial vision for E was to have a lot of original content, when did that, in the E life cycle, when did that start happening?
It started after about 2 years. We started doing, covering things like the Academy Award, not the awards themselves, but, you know, the entrances getting on the carpet.
Were you invited with open arms to those events?
No, we weren't. As a matter of fact, the first one we ever did was at the Shrine Center. And we literally climbed over the fence. We had an entire camera crew. We climbed over one of the back fences and we had no credentials, nothing. But we got great things. And, you know, again, being the first one from Hollywood, like a lot of people in the business started looking at us and saying, you know, this is actually kind of cool because we were covering parts of the business that were never covered. Yeah. I mean, people would fight for their 20 seconds on Entertainment Tonight. And here, you know, we were willing to do a 30-minute show on the making of a movie. And, you know, movie trailers was never really an art. A lot of people understood until we came around and made it that.
That's incredible. So within the store, you start making your own content. Was Talk Soup your first original piece?
Talk Soup was the first original, and again, out of necessity, because we could get the clips. Again, I mean, they, you know, from the Jerry Springer show and all that. And, you know, Greg was fabulous. Greg Kinnear was the first host, and he was fabulous. It was an easy show for us to do, very economical. But it was interesting because when we did it, and originally it was actually going to be called Talk Soap. We were thinking of doing a TV show for women who love soap operas that work, and they get home at 7 o'clock at night and they don't know what happened on their favorite soap operas. But we couldn't clear the clips.
Okay.
So we said, let's call Jerry Springer. And, you know, they were more than happy to give us the clips. Yeah. So when people heard, they said, Larry, we think you lost your mind. I go, why? They go, you want to do a TV show that makes fun of TV shows. And I was like, exactly. And they were like, okay, whatever. But as soon as you went on, you know, Greg was just so fabulous. You had to love that show. And again, it was very pirate.
That was a great show.
Yeah. And it ran 25 years.
That's unbelievable. I mean, I can think of two hosts, obviously Greg Kinnear and then Joel McHale. Those are the two that resonate with my lifespan. So what an incredible show. How old was E when acquisition conversations were being made?
About 2 or 3 days. As soon as it went on the air, people came to us and said, oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
They said, well, why didn't you tell us that's what you wanted to do? We would have given you that money 3 years ago. So it was just one of those things that as soon as you saw it, you just had to like hit yourself in the head and go, oh, my God, of course. You know, and again, you had all the stats saying, you know, that the entertainment pages were the second most popular in any Sunday newspaper and stuff. And here you had it in a video version.
Let's ask a couple retrospective questions. What do you say to those who hear this, the E story, your journey, and say, well, it was just all perfect timing. Like that can never happen today.
I think you see it happen time and time again today. I mean, the world is much more open. Then you needed, you know, to start a media venture, you know, of that size and scale, you needed $60 million. I mean, now I could literally do it on a laptop.
Yeah.
The barriers to entry are way down. You know, when I first started getting in the business, you know, video was 2-inch tape and giant machines that cost $2 million each and stuff like that. And, you know, we just watched it come down. I mean, now you could record an unbelievable video on your iPhone.
Isn't that crazy?
it's actually much, much easier now to be creative and inventive and be much more catering to consumer needs.
Yeah. So if you were to start now, I know you have a current venture, Meitan, which is content in China, right? But if you were to do this again in the States, what steps would you take differently?
So, well, first, I wouldn't do linear television.
Can you explain linear television?
Linear television is the old style TV networks like NBC, ABC, CBS, okay. Where, you know, tune in Thursday night at 9 o'clock and we have whatever.
Got it.
If you want to watch Seinfeld, you had to watch it when NBC wanted to watch it, not when you wanted to watch it. I've always kind of been thinking forward, like how technology fundamentally changes the business and stuff. And, you know, to me, when all this digital technology came around, you know, you could look at storage. As storage gets bigger, 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 cheaper, cheaper, cheaper. Mm-hmm. And it will continue. So you just kind of play it out. You say, what happens when it gets real big and real cheap? You say, then you have the ability to have, you know, things in your home that, you know, allow you to record and store and then watch things when you want. And then you say, okay, when you get really big, you could have things in the cloud, or it wasn't called the cloud then, that every program ever made could be stored somewhere and called up when someone wants to watch it. The changes are, you know, amazing. I mean, thinking of networks as brands disappears. I mean, I don't go home to watch NBC. I go home to watch certain programs and stuff. So I would not do anything linear again. Again, simple thing. Do you want to watch what you want to watch when you want to watch it, or do you want to watch when NBC wants you to watch when they want you to watch it? We all know the answer to the question. Yeah. You know, now you spread that out. You say, now beyond being able to watch it on time, you could watch it on the device you want. I mean, I could watch a program on this big TV here, and then I could leave the house and, you know, sitting on an airplane, see the end of the movie on my cell phone or my pad or whatever. So, you know, that's a major, major change. It's putting back control in the hands of the consumer, you know, which means you better be good. I mean, they're not forced to watch your stuff anymore. It better be good stuff.
Yeah.
So it's really forced the elevation of quality. I think it's forced the elevation of the quality of, you know, what's out there and stuff. I mean, today there's so many platforms that are doing incredible stuff in the visual entertainment. I don't even call it film or television. It's visual entertainment. Yeah. Because I don't think it makes any difference what you watch it on, as long as you get to watch what you want.
Looking back on your journey, I'm a big believer in mentorship. Like, I just think, you know, the entrepreneurial journey, people say, is lonely. And it can be lonely, but it doesn't have to be. And I think part of why it's lonely is we get so focused on the tasks that have to be accomplished in order to grow a business, whatever the business is. And looking back on your journey through E, Meitan, all the other ventures you've had in between, are there people that you point to as your mentors?
Yeah, there are. When I worked at Manhattan Cable, I reported to then vice president of operations who moved higher, then a guy named Frank Ciano. Frank had a similar background to me. He kind of came from a very modest family and stuff and just worked really hard and stuff. It was tough as hell when he needed to be. So I learned an amazing amount from him. And then when all the Time Inkers kind of took over and I became closer, you know, I discovered them and they discovered me. So probably the most is a guy named Nick Nicholas. Nick came in from Time Inc. to be the president of Manhattan Cable with the job to grow the business.
Okay.
I mean, so he was really there in a growth mode. Frank was more in the let's maintain the customer mode. So I learned a lot from Nick, and Nick eventually went on to become the president of Time Warner. And, you know, but I was there through, you know, the beginning of HBO with Jerry Levin and the video group. I was part of that growth with, you know, the guy who ran it was a guy named Dick Monroe. So those are all the guys who kind of set the tone for me, which was great because then I had this entrepreneurial spirit, but yet I had corporate discipline.
Yeah.
And I knew the way those guys thought and how they played the game. And I also understood very clearly the timing involved in what they had to do versus the timing involved in what I had to do. Mm. So that's why a lot of the stuff I did, I went in very confidently, is, you know, because I could say I know how to play that game, but I could play it a lot faster than they can.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have boards of directors to go through and shareholders and, you know, writing reports. If I felt something was good, I could just pull the trigger and do it. And that's what let E become. A lot of it was improvised. I mean, a lot of it we didn't really go out there knowing, but somebody would come to us with an opportunity and we go, sure. You know, when the Wayans brothers first started on trying to get on television, we let them host. You know, they would walk in and say, hey, we have nothing to do. We go, here, you know, here's a microphone.
That's
you could
fantastic.
Be the host of the next hour. Paula Abdul and stuff. So we kind of became almost a clubhouse for Hollywood. It was just a comfortable place to go and hang out. And if we felt like doing something, I mean, one day we had Jack Lemmon, we brought a piano on the set and we had Jack Lemmon play the piano instead
That's
of doing
incredible.
An interview because he didn't like doing interviews. And then every agent in town was like, how did you get Jack Lemmon to come on? He doesn't do that.
That
and we
so
go,
cool.
we just let him do what he wanted to do, not what we wanted him to do.
So I have to ask a question I did not intend on asking until you brought up Jack Lemmon's story. When you look back at your career at E, specifically E, what is one, would it be an interview, that one moment that you look back on, and that is your fondest memory of that period?
Well, I mean, the launch, obviously. But, you know, after we were going and I got a call from Warner Brothers. Well, the two. One is I got a call from Warner Brothers, you know, which was kind of, wow, Warner Brothers calling me, asking me if they could borrow Greg Kinnear to do a pilot of a TV show.
Oh,
and
wow.
I, you know, and of course I agreed. It was something called College Funhouse, and I just had a very short run. But, you know, going, wow, that's really weird that, you know, Warner Brothers calling me to borrow some of our people. The other was we had the last studio to kind of sign on with us was Paramount. And no matter what we would do, they wouldn't give us clips. They wouldn't advertise with us. They wouldn't do anything. So when we used to do the movie countdown, you know, whether it be Greg Kinnear or DeCarlo or whatever, we go, and the number 10 movie for last week was blah, blah, blah from Disney. And the number 9 was blah, blah, blah from Columbia. And the number 8 was, oh, some studio starts with a P. Don't even bother with that one. And I had a friend at Paramount who told me that the president of Paramount literally came down to the marketing department and screamed at them going, I don't know who this company is, I don't know what, but I don't want to hear this anymore. You figure out a way to work with those guys. And we started working with Paramount right after that.
So one of the things that I love about the E story is that 2.5 year mark, one of your partners wants out, you're down to your last $60. You know, one of the personas of the listeners might just be that entrepreneur that just isn't getting traction and isn't sure if it's time to call it quits or not. What do you say to that person in that journey?
Well, I mean, number one, you got to do a real honest assessment there. You know, you can't let your emotions get in the way of really figuring out, you know, was this a good idea to begin with? Is it still a good idea? Sometimes time just passes you by and, you know, well, was a good idea 2 years ago, may not be. But a lot of people hang on to those way too long. And I think that's the downfall of a lot of people is they just hang on to an idea who might have started out well, but now technology is kind of past it and stuff. So number one is make that honest assessment. And if you're so convinced, you know, just hang on to your dreams. I mean, if you really believe in it, you got to go for it.
Yeah. Or evolve, right? I mean, evolve. If you're so passionate about it, it's like, what is that next? What is that evolution of whatever your initiative is?
And it all evolves. I mean, even when you take E, we started out one way and, you know, then, you know, obviously we went into, you know, the Howard Stern show and E! Hollywood True Story. And, you know, so, yeah, it's a progression. I mean, you look now at any TV, you look at CBS and you say, you know, is it what Bill Paley envisioned in, you know, 1940 something? And the answer is no, it evolved.
Yeah.
But it's still his baby.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of reading and I always want to ask the question, what books have helped shape you?
There was a book, one of the most, Juan Enriquez was called As the Future Catches You. And it was just really focused on thinking about the what, can be versus the what is. And it's just a way of thinking.
Yeah.
Those who have noticed my Bruce Lee books.
Oh, yeah.
Bruce was much more than a fighter. Bruce was a philosopher. And he was really into be the best. Don't try and be someone else and stuff like that. Be the best you can be. And it really convinced me I didn't have to be Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah.
You know, I could be me and be successful in my way. Not I didn't have to be in someone else's way.
Was that something that was constantly present in your mind as you were building E? Was that I've got to beat Rupert Murdoch?
Well, that was kind of, that was what other people expected. And yeah. Unfortunately, it's when people meet me, you know, a lot of them are taken back because they expect me to be that. Mm. You know, they go, oh, you know, he started TV networks. He's a mogul. And, you know, I listen to some of the descriptions, you know, and I go, and then they realize I'm still, you know, the son of a Pepsi Cola driver from Brooklyn. And, you know, I don't live in giant mansions and fly in private planes and stuff. I like my quiet. I like my privacy.
Yeah.
You know, I want my kids to grow up with values and stuff like that. So I kind of, you know, so while E obviously is huge, you know, I kind of carefully moderate that whole thing.
That's incredible. And Larry, I really do appreciate you affording me this opportunity for the Startup Story podcast, but all the other times you've given me your time to share the story. I learn from you each and every time. I know our listeners have probably learned a tremendous amount as well. It is incredible to just get your perspective with all your experience. So thank you so very much.
Well, so sometimes it's fun to think back on some of those funny experiences. So thank you.
Over the last year, I have had the good fortune of meeting with Larry a few times for various reasons, and every single time I learn something new from him. His experience gives me a perspective I did not have before. One of the narratives that I shake my head at is when I hear people talking about the days of old or the golden era that will never happen again. You hear people talk about how they missed the dot-com boom in the mid to late 90s or the mobile app blitz of the mid 2000s. Hearing from Larry how much easier it would be today to start a media network tells me that the best opportunities are still ahead of us. Think about what he said regarding the ability to record from your mobile phone versus needing to obtain expensive commercial-grade video equipment, like he had to when he started E, or being able to leverage platforms like YouTube or IGTV to create a viewership as opposed to being dependent on cable distribution. Don't believe the false narrative that all the great ideas or opportunities have passed. Now is the time to move on your idea. Larry is still moving on new ideas that he has. Aside from his company, Meitan Global, that content producer in mainland China, he has a startup called Yuzzle. That's Yuzzl.com. It's a platform that started by merchandising some hilarious tweets from our president and has since grown to allow other brands to establish their own storefront. You know, I believe in entrepreneurs helping other entrepreneurs, so please check out Yuzzl.com, again, Yuzzl.com, to see if there's a way to support a fellow entrepreneur. Now, here's my personal ask from one founder to another. The Startup Story community has been so incredible about sharing our podcast with others, but we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We too are a startup, and word of mouth is everything. So please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Startup Story, or on Twitter at StartupStory_. If you're on LinkedIn, please search for The Startup Story and follow our company page. LinkedIn is a really powerful way to raise awareness of the show. But the most impactful way you can help us grow our audience is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Or if you listen to the show via Spotify, then please simply share the podcast directly from your Spotify app or wherever you listen to the show. These simple actions can make a huge impact in getting these amazing founder stories out to the masses. And please make sure to tag or mention The Startup Story when you do share so that we can connect with you and say thank you directly. I'm so incredibly appreciative of the fact that you listen to the show each and every week. And I look forward to sharing these amazing stories with you every Tuesday with hopes of encouraging and inspiring you to start your story. If you like this podcast and are thinking of creating your own, consider talking to my producer, Danny Osmond. He helps thought leaders, influencers, executives, and authors create, launch, and produce podcasts that grow their business and make a real impact in this world. You can contact him today at emeraldcitypro.com/startupstory.